In the spring, at a time when kings go off to war, David sent Joab out with the king's men and the whole Israelite army. They destroyed the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah, but David remained in Jerusalem. One evening, David got up from his bed and walked around on the roof of the palace. From the roof, he saw a woman bathing. The woman was very beautiful, and David sent someone to find out about her. The man said, "She is Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, and the wife of Uriah the Hittite." Then David sent messengers to get her. She came to him, and he slept with her. Now she was purifying herself from her monthly uncleanness. Then she went back home. The woman conceived and sent word to David saying, "I am pregnant." So David sent this word to Joab, "Send me Uriah the Hittite," and Joab sent him to David. When Uriah came to him, David asked him how Joab was, how the soldiers were, and how the war was going. Then David said to Uriah, "Go down to your house and wash your feet." So Uriah left the palace, and a gift from the king was sent after him. But Uriah slept at the entrance to the palace with all the master's servants and did not go down to his house. David was told Uriah did not go home. So he asked Uriah, "Haven't you just come from a military campaign? Why didn't you go home?" Uriah said to David, "The ark and Israel and Judah are staying in tents, and my commander Joab and my lord's men are camped in the open country. How could I go to my house to eat and drink and make love to my wife? As surely as you live, I will not do such a thing." Then David said to him, "Stay here one more day, and tomorrow I will send you back." So Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day and the next. At David's invitation, he ate and drank with him, and David made him drunk. But in the evening, Uriah went out to sleep on his mat among his master's servants. He did not go home. In the morning, David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it with Uriah. In it, he wrote, "Put Uriah out in front where the fighting is fierce. Then withdraw from him so he will be struck down and die." So while Joab had the city under siege, he put Uriah at a place where he knew the strongest defenders were. When the men of the city came out and fought against Joab, some of the men in David's army fell. Moreover, Uriah the Hittite died. Joab sent David a full account of the battle. He instructed the messenger, "When you have finished giving the king this account of the battle, the king's anger may flare up, and he may ask you, 'Why did you get so close to the city to fight? Didn't you know they would shoot arrows from the wall? Who killed Abimelech, son of Jerubbaasheth? Didn't a woman drop an upper millstone on him from the wall so that he died in Thebes? Why did you get so close to the wall?' If he asks you this, then say to him, 'Moreover, your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead.'" The messenger set out, and when he arrived, he told David everything Joab had sent him to say. The messenger said to David, "The men overpowered us and came out against us in the open. But we drove them back to the entrance of the city gate. Then the archers shot arrows at your servants from the wall, and some of the king's men died. Moreover, your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead." David told the messenger, "Say this to Joab, 'Don't let this upset you. The sword devours one as well as the other. Press the attack against the city and destroy it. Say this to encourage Joab. When Uriah's wife heard that her husband was dead, she mourned for him. After this time of mourning was over, David had her brought to his house, and she became his wife, and she bore him a son. But the thing David had done displeased the Lord.
Good morning. Before we start, I just want to acknowledge we have a pew that's empty over here, and we had a chair in Ernest's class where Ralph always sat that was empty. So we miss Ralph. We offer our condolences to the Whitmers and all the family, and we anticipate accompanying Ralph on his final journey in song next week. So just want to invite you all to come out to that service at Greenford Christian. We talked last week about the vice of greed, and I don't know about you, but maybe it's because I wrestled with it all week. I found myself wiped out after that. It was heavy, it was challenging, and so I hope you're relieved that we're moving on to the much lighter subject of lust. More seriously, I just want to say I'm really impressed with how many of you have opened yourself up to this series. I've had a couple conversations with people this week, and I think greed was particularly seemed to kind of strike a nerve. And I hope you heard me saying last week, I'm with you here, that we sit under Jesus' teaching together. Just because I'm up here doesn't mean I'm not sitting under the teaching too. But I just want to affirm your openness to this series. This is tough stuff. And just your desire to grow as disciples. Like that we don't reach a certain age where we're still not open to learning and growing as disciples. So I just want to say that God honors that desire, and I just want to just affirm that. Okay, so here's the deal with lust. I don't know how to talk about lust without talking about sex. If you remember Carla Minter from Mennonite Mission Network, she came here and she had memorized an entire passage, and she performed that for us very beautifully. And before she started, she told us, she said, don't get nervous. Like, I may mess up, but you don't need to feel embarrassed for me or anxious for me. And so she was giving us this permission not to feel embarrassed. And I can't control how you're feeling, but I want to give you permission, like, you don't need to feel embarrassed or anxious for me. In some ways, strangely, I find preaching in front of a room full of people much less intimidating than talking to my own kids about this. And as I've thought about this, it's interesting because many of you have seen a dramatic shift in our culture in the way we approach sex. So if you remember the 1950s show, I Love Lucy, my parents were one at the time it came out, but I even know this, that people noticed later on that Lucy and Ricky were always in separate beds, these twin-sized beds that were in their room, and that reflected the conservative nature of the time, of the show, and of not wanting to be so explicit about sex between a married couple. So many of you will remember I Love Lucy, like you remember that. So fast forward to 2019, and you cannot turn on your TV, you cannot open up Netflix or your internet browser or walk by the checkout line at the grocery store with sex not being right there in front of your face. It's really a dramatic change in one lifetime. And here's what I think is interesting about this as I've thought about it, is that despite how public sex is, my guess is that this still kind of elicits some conflicting feelings of both finding your ears perked up, like maybe this isn't the sermon to take a nap, but at the same time, like a little bit of squeamish, like maybe I picked the wrong Sunday to be here. It's this kind of conflicted feeling. I see it in my kids of like, I don't want anything to do with that, and yet I'm interested in that. I mean, I think they kind of express more visibly what we're feeling but don't always express. So despite how public sex is, it remains a paradox. Rebecca DeYoung asks the question in her book, Glaring Devices, is sex the enemy, The forbidden fruit, the greatest and most shameful of all sins, or is it the key to happiness? Is it the ultimate fulfillment of desire? Does it mean nothing or everything? Why is it so taboo that we can't talk about it, and yet so ubiquitous that we see it everywhere? All the more reason why I think we need a Christian perspective on sex. Because it is everywhere, and yet often we don't hear kind of what the Christian perspective on this is. So we're going to begin with lust. We're going to break these sermons up. We're going to start with lust. And if you look in your bulletin, you don't have to look at it now, but you've probably noticed that throughout this series, the first sermon is a disoriented love, and then we reorient the love, and then we go into what the reoriented love is. So this change of desire. And I think that's important because, and some of you may say, like, I don't understand that. That doesn't make sense to me. Like, this is the vice I think that's really helpful in kind of explaining what we mean on a shift from a disoriented love to a reoriented love. Because if you notice, of all these deadly or cardinal sins, at their roots, they are good things. They're good desires. They are natural passions. And the reason they become vices and they're known as vices is because somewhere along the way, something that's good becomes twisted. It gets disoriented. It goes awry. And so last week we talked about greed. Greed comes from the natural desire to care for oneself, to care for one's family, to provide for yourself and the people you love, to have enough. Okay, that's a natural desire. That's not a bad desire. Where that desire gets twisted is that when we shift our trust from God to provide for us to ourselves, and that no matter how much we acquire, it's never enough. So we build these bigger barns, we build these bigger bank accounts, we build these bigger retirement accounts. And when we do that, we lose trust in God providing for us. And we take it on ourselves to be the ones that make sure we have enough. And that is not good for generosity. It's not good for sharing our resources with other people. So what is the good desire behind lust? Because there is a good desire behind lust. I mean, lust is one of those words that immediately has all these negative connotations that we need to back up a little bit and realize that that desire behind lust is a good desire. And we'll spend more in the second half of the sermon talking about that. But we want to start out by affirming sexual desire, affirming sex as good. Lust, which is not good, is when that good desire for sex goes awry. And here's the way that happens with lust. Sex is pleasurable, physically pleasurable. Sex is also complex. It's powerful. It's emotional. It's a way we serve another person. It's a way we unite with another person. It's the way we bring new life into the world. In other words, that physical pleasure is one component of sex out of a whole package. And what lust does is it takes that one thing, that physical pleasure, and it pulls it out of that whole package, and it says sex is just about this. And so what lust does is it degrades, it cheapens the fullness and wholeness of sex. Lust is very much focused on the self. You know, lust tends to be all about me. It's about my sexual pleasure. Rebecca DeYoung says that it turns sex into a self-gratification project, so it's a party of one. And I want to point that out because sometimes I think we think of sexual lust as just something in our heads, as just something for maybe people who are not married, who are not who are having sex. But lust goes way beyond that. So you can experience lust as a person that's not sexually active, is single. You can experience lust as someone who's in a committed relationship with a spouse. Because what lust really wants is it. Lust wants it. Lust is much less concerned about the beloved person behind it. And so what happens when lust is present in a person in a relationship, it turns another person into an object, what I think is helpful is a tool or an instrument. And once you've used that person as an instrument, I mean, think about it, you grab a tool off. Once it's done, once you've used it, it doesn't serve you any, so you put it back. And that's a little bit like what we do with lust. Once I've gotten out of you what I want, whether it's through my head or through my actual body, I'm done with you. I'm going to put you back up on the shelf. And there's actually a lot of similarities between the cardinal sins of gluttony and lust, because both of them are dealing with physical pleasures, sex in the terms of lust, and eating in terms of gluttony. Eating is a pleasurable, it's a necessary activity, and we'll talk about this more one of these weeks in gluttony, but gluttony happens when we see food as its main purpose is to just give us comfort and pleasure. And so what happens with gluttony is that it's hard to be satisfied with just simple foods. We've got to have more and more and more to satisfy us. And what often happens is we try to fill voids in our life with food. I think we've all experienced that to some degree. You're having a tough day. You want to, you know, it feels good to eat something. So gluttony ends up being we do that to fill big voids in our life. And the person who lusts does something similar. The difference is that they use people. So food is an inanimate object. It doesn't necessarily have feelings. Well, I guess meat, maybe. I'm not going to go there, but it's mostly an inanimate object by the time we're eating it. So we're not harming the food when we're eating it. But it's very different with people. And I don't think we speak about it so crudely, but kind of the way our culture treats sex is basically like an appetite. I think people would say, oh, no, surely not. But here's the message I mostly hear. Sex is normal. Sex is good. Sex is a biological need. It's just like eating. When you're hungry for food, what do? You eat. When you are hungry for sex, what do? You have sex. And this is important because we're kind of getting down into what the basic ethic of our culture is in sex. And this is, as far as I can tell, this is kind of what we've boiled this down to. The ethic of sex, the direction from our culture, is that you have to have two consenting adults. Meaning you cannot bring a minor into it. As long as you have a consenting adult, that's fine. And that's basically the guidance that our culture gives us. As long as the other person consents, you are okay. Don't feel bad about these normal, healthy desires, these appetites. And we've been given this message for so long, it's kind of hard to even step back and recognize, but is this working? Is this ethic that we're given by our culture, which even as Christians, if we're totally honest, we have adopted much of that ethic, is that working? And I was listening to a sermon by Tim Keller, and he recounts a 1940s BBC program in which C.S. Lewis, this is amazing because this is like, I don't know, 70 years ago now, but C.S. Lewis uses this analogy to talk about sexuality and to kind of look at this question. Is something gone wrong with this appetite for sex? And Lewis says on the program, imagine going to a country where young men go off to college and the first thing they do when they get to their dorm rooms is that they put up these great big posters, color, life size of food, of hot dogs and hamburgers and ice cream, and the grease just kind of drips off the hamburger. And imagine then once those guys get their own posters up, they go then from room to room and they see that the other guys have posters and they say, oh, wow, look at this one. And then you realize these guys, this is the 1940s, so this is going to be a little dated, but these guys, they go on Saturday to a club. And they pay lots of money to be there. And at the club, there's these low lights, and there's this music, and everyone's sitting around a stage, and their tongues are just hanging out, and on the stage is something covered. And slowly, bit by bit, the cover is pulled off in rhythm with the music. And as it is slowly pulled off, bit by bit, you begin to see that it's a roast turkey. And once that is off, everyone just goes crazy and whistles and screams and yells. And the next night, they go back the same thing to see a hot dog unveiled. And it's funny, but what hit me is like, that person would say, what has gone wrong with people's appetite for food? They would say, these people must be starving. They must be starved for food, which explains why they put up these posters and go to these clubs where roast turkeys are uncovered. But if you kept talking to them, you realize these people are not starving. In fact, they've been told they can eat as much food as they possibly want. And you would probably say, something has gone wrong here. Something has gone awry. Something with their appetite and desire from food has gone wrong. Something's disordered about this appetite. And it's obviously, it's funny, but it lifts off the veil about kind of what often is ridiculous behavior, which is seen as completely normal in our culture. So, I mean, fast forward today, and you would have somebody who knew nothing about our culture that would probably come in and just see how rampant pornography is in our culture, how people's days and even lives in some extreme can be consumed with pornography, and they would say, something has gone wrong. Why do people do this? They must not ever be having sex. But then you talk and you realize for the last 60 years, people have been told they can have as much sex as they want. And you would probably say, what has gone wrong here? And the point is, when you look at sex as purely an appetite, if you really step back a little bit and you think, is that the horse you want to lead you? Where does that exactly lead you if you treat it like an appetite? And think about sex as an appetite is that when it goes awry, it can get really bad. Like I said, when your desire for food goes awry, there's some self-harm that's afflicted to yourself, maybe others a little bit, but totally different when your appetite for sex goes awry because it's so much more powerful and it has the potential to inflict so much more harm. So we can start kind of low. We can take pornography, I mentioned, and put that in the context of a married couple. And that has the potential to harm the person consuming the pornography, but it also has the potential to harm the marriage. So it brings in unrealistic expectations about bodies to the marriage, about what sex is. It brings in a lot of things, and it can create challenges within that marriage. And then if you keep following lust, like if you move to actually where the lust is acted out outside the marriage, then you have, in the form of an affair, then you have the potential to destroy a family. You have congregations that are ripped apart. I mean, we don't have to look very far. We've often seen this, the people in leadership in congregations have done this. Families are destroyed. Or, I've just been following the story of Jeffrey Epstein. If you don't know, he's that guy from New York. He was rich, he was powerful, he was famous, he had enablers, and he had a massive appetite for sex, really disordered. But he had all these things that allowed him to basically act out on his appetite. Epstein hung himself in a jail. Epstein's legacy will live a long time. The people that he hurt through his sexual appetite will be dealing with his transgressions the rest of their life, and maybe even to the next generation. And my point is not always that it leads to extremes like Epstein. My point is because sex and sexual desire is so powerful, and because it involves other people, when it goes awry, it goes really awry. It can blow up bridges. And we don't just see this around us now. This isn't just a modern problem. The power of sex is laid out very clearly in the story that Gloria so well read of David and Bathsheba in 2 Samuel. So the story opens up. Sorry, let me get a drink here real fast. The story's open up. It's spring. The rains have ended. That means they can go on their military campaigns. Interestingly, David doesn't go. He hasn't had a fear of fighting, but this time he doesn't go. And there's a scene opens where David's up high on his palace, and he's looking down, and he sees a woman, a beautiful woman. He doesn't know her name. It's interesting, actually in the text you'll notice, even after he learns Bathsheba's name, he doesn't call her by her name. He just sends the messengers to get her. And David sees her, and he finds her beautiful. We have no hint that David has any care or affection or love for Bathsheba. The look of David is the look of lust. It's an objectifying look. I mean, remember I was describing to you what lust is. It objectifies a person. It turns them into a tool. This is exactly what David is doing. David wants it, David does not care about who is behind it. David's appetite has been wet. He sees this. David is also powerful. He's a king. And so, like as I talked about with Epstein, he has the potential to satisfy almost any appetite, any desire he wants. He wants Bathsheba. And he has the power to act on that. And sometimes you'll read in commentaries where someone will bring up the question, you know, was Bathsheba totally innocent? But look at this. Was she even consulted? She's just sent for. David just tells her to come. And when you are a woman whose husband has gone off to war and the king sends for you, you are in a powerless position. I mean, if you see the dynamic here, it looks like basically rape. And I was reading one of the commentaries, a guy who interviewed some women in South Africa, where patriarchy would be stronger than here in the U.S., and all these women in South Africa named it as rape. They said, of course that's rape. I mean, when you see that happening in a culture where there's this kind of dynamic, you know, you recognize immediately it's rape. David sleeps with Bathsheba. She sends word back that I'm pregnant. What does that mean? Well, what it means in the Mosaic Law, if you look in Deuteronomy, is both of them are dead. Both of them are dead. That's the punishment for what they've done. So what does David do? He comes clean, right? He calls a press conference. He calls his wife to come stand by him. And in this very serious but a little bit defiant manner, he apologizes to everyone he's hurt with his actions, usually except the woman who remains nameless, who again becomes it, but this time a problem. That's not what happens. I'm getting ahead of myself. What happens first is they try to cover it up. And that's exactly what David does. Does this sound familiar? It's like, you wonder why we all know this story, and it's like this combination of like a Shakespearean drama and like something we see all the time. All the time. Like you can probably think of 10 instances in your head where you've seen this exact same scenario play out. And so it's like, it's so much drama, but it's so familiar to us. Not just in politics or business, churches, it's in the lives of people we know. And David then has a plan how to make this right. They always have a plan. They always have a plan. He calls Bathsheba's husband Uriah, who's out fighting David's war, and he says, go down to your house and wash your feet. Now that's, if you wash your feet is a delicate and indirect way of saying, go home and have sex with your wife. But guess what? Uriah won't do it. Uriah is too devoted to his fellow soldiers to sleep with his wife while they're out camped in the field and fighting in this war. And so David, who already is looking really bad, now looks really bad. Because Uriah is the one who's showing the real character here, and David is just looking worse and worse. So what does David do? He sends him off, doesn't work, tries to then get him drunk the next night, still doesn't work. Uriah is standing, really firm on this, and so then David turns to murder. And David does this thing where he writes this note telling the general, the commander of the army, to put Uriah in danger. So get him right up there where he's likely to get killed. And then he hands a note to Uriah. So it doesn't look like Uriah knows what's happening, but Uriah is basically asked to deliver his death warrant. Just another just kind of crazy thing about this story. So Uriah goes back, and the plan is enacted. He's put up front. He's shot through with an arrow and killed. Bathsheba learns that her husband is dead, and she mourns. And after the time of mourning, David brings Bathsheba to his house, makes her his wife, and then she bears him a son. And then the story ends with this kind of haunting line, but the thing David had done displeased the Lord. So our story begins with what looks like a harmless look on a rooftop. And by the end of it, what is the collateral damage here? What did that look set in motion? Well, we have a king who used his royal power to essentially rape a woman. That's bad. Which then produced a child who is then going to eventually die in the next chapter because of David's action. We have David involving, making somebody else culpable for his what he's done by getting the general involved in this. And then Uriah is murdered. But if you look, it's not just Uriah, it's all these other men too that have sent up with Uriah to fight this. This was all set in motion by David being up on the roof and having a look at Bathsheba. And you could say, well, that's extreme. People don't usually die when lust happens. But I think most of us have seen enough in our lives to know that the damage of lust works exactly that way. It's like a rippling effect. It extends out, and it hurts people far removed from what that actual one sexual act occurred. As DeYoung says, even if we are not directly burned by lust's fire, lust smoke can cause damage far and wide. We often live with lust's collateral damage for the long term. So what do we do? We're going to do what we've done each week. We're going to take a moment. We're going to take an honest look at ourselves. Most of us, you know, thankfully, have not acted like King David. But if we're willing to take that look in ourselves, we're going to see some things we are not proud of. We're going to recognize lust in our life. We're going to recognize the time that we've used other people, maybe not just sexually, but we've used someone else as an instrument to gratify us. We've used people as tools. And in doing so, we've not only harmed ourselves, we've sinned against God, we've not followed Jesus' teachings on lust, and we have hurt other people. And so we need to confess, and we need to repent. And Greg is going to lead us in a time of doing that now. Okay, so if lust is when something good, sexual desire and sex becomes twisted, what is chastity? Well, if lust is a misdirected love, a disordered love, chastity is putting love in the right place, in the appropriate ways. And this is a big topic. This is just a huge topic, and I'm not going to get to cover everything. One thing in particular I realize I'm not going to get to cover is what chastity looks like for single people. And I just want to say, I want to come back to this at some point because this is something, the single life is something the church has often failed to honor. I mean, of course, we have Jesus and Paul. We have all these people who are single. It doesn't make sense why we've done that, but that's just the reality. So I'm going to be talking mostly about sex within marriage, but please hear this as if you are single like that, I want to talk about that because it's a very fair question. I'm just not going to be able to cover it today. So what do we do with sexual desire? What is appropriately placed and expressed sexual desire? Well, I gave you kind of the mainstream cultures. I hope I did that accurately. I think that's what I get of sex. But here's the Christian perspective. The Christian perspective is sex is designed to be between one man and one woman within the context of marriage. This has basically been the position of the Christian church throughout history, around the world, in all major branches of Christianity, Catholic, Orthodox, and Protestant. In the last 15 to 20 years, there's been a couple of Protestant denominations, mostly in North America, who have asked the question, can that be a couple who is in a same-sex marriage? But the vast majority of the world, and probably still today in North America, would define that as the teaching position of the church. So that's the one I'm going to be operating with. Which is really remarkable when you think about it. Like, think about all the things we disagree on, which is like sometimes seems like everything. It's probably not. But we pretty much, that doesn't mean it's been followed, but we pretty much throughout history have agreed on this. And this would be, again, not that it's been practiced always, but we've pretty much agreed on it as various streams of the Christian faith. And I'm also just very aware in our country today, particularly this idea of sex only being within the context of marriage, that this position is seen at best naive, and at worst, so naive and really out of step with the culture and time. And at worst, I've heard this as a very harmful position, a very hurtful position. The Christian. Now, granted, lots of people have been hurt by teaching on sex, But often that's because we just move off of what the Bible says. But and not that I'm going to do it perfectly, but I'm going to try to look at this what the Bible says. But what we tend to hear in our culture is that was appropriate for another era, another time, maybe when we were more sexually repressed. But it's just utterly unrealistic and, like I said, possibly harmful to hold to that position today, that sex is only within the context of marriage. But, you know, that's been attacked for a long time. But lately, in the last few years, I've seen a lot more people asking the question, really, is monogamy possible? So not even talking about marriage. I read an article in New York Times, I think it was a month ago, called Polyamory Works for Them. So he was questioning if monogamy is even ideal for all couples. We live so much longer these days. Is that really fair to ask someone to only have one partner? So these questions are always arising about, is this not even just within marriage, but just one partner is very unrealistic by some people. So the idea, to even bring up the idea of putting sex within marriage just sounds ludicrous. And if we don't get with the times as a church, we're going to lose these people, right? Like a lot of our culture's thoughts on sex, this is what I've realized, is that the Bible is almost always way more nuanced than our culture. Our culture has these very simplistic definitions of what sex is and what it's for. And if you look at the Bible, it's always so much more nuanced. That's why I always get so upset when people claim that Christians aren't thinking people, because I think we're the most thinking people about a lot of these things. And here's what I think people tend to forget about this. Christianity arose in the context of the Roman Empire. And the Roman Empire did not hold the Christian understanding of sex, particularly for men. Men were basically free to choose to be sexually active with who they wanted. It was a loose culture, in other words. And what happened, so the early church began to move through the Roman Empire, and what happened is that they started, a lot of them were not practicing this teaching on sex, but they started to practice it, and they began to follow the teachings of Jesus on this. And they began to change some of their sexual practices. And Alan Kreider, former Mennonite scholar and missionary, wrote a really widely acclaimed book in the Mennonite church nowadays called The Patient Ferment of the Early Church. And in the book, Kreider talks about how improbable the rise of Christianity was in the Roman Empire. And it's not a big section, but I did find one little section in there in which he talks about how these communities of faith were distinctive from the Roman culture around them. Like, what made them distinctive? And he names a number of things, and one of them had to do with sexual discipline. So when someone was going through a long catechesis, like a long preparation for joining the church, they were asked questions about their sexual discipline. So they were asked things like, what is your sexual behavior? What are your marital commitments? Because they did not want sexual scandal in the church. But here's what I think is so interesting that Kreider says. We put up that first. So then he continues, but the Christians were not concerned simply to avoid scandal. They believed that sexual purity was crucially important in forming Christian character and in shaping viable communities. Further, the Christians believed that sexual purity was a means of attracting outsiders. You see what he's saying there? He's saying something that for our ears is just startling. He's saying that these sexual ethics actually attracted people into the church. That when they saw these people become Christians and begin to change their sexual practices, it became deeply attractive to people who were outside because they began to see the power of putting sex within the context of lifelong fidelity in a marriage. So the idea that sexual ethics now or in the Christian are repressive or naive and we've moved past that is just not accurate. That you might hear that all the time, but that is just not accurate. And so we can't say like it's out of step with the culture, because the reality is we've always been out of step with the culture. And yet, what the church has found is that this has the potential to transform lives. That once people step into the sexual ethic of Christianity, they realize there is power in that. There's power to these boundaries that we put around sex. And I think the only way, and this is going to be hard, the only way I think you can understand this is to understand what the Bible teaches sex is for. Because these boundaries, and often we fail to really give a very articulate reason of why we put sex within the context of marriage. But listen to the Bible. Don't always listen to us preachers who kind of bumble our ways through it. Listen to the Bible. I'll try to do my best here. There's three purposes for sex in the Christian marriage. Number one, sex is designed to create human beings. So it might seem pretty obvious to all of us. We learned this very early. But you know, with birth control now, it's easy to forget like that is a purpose of sex. Obviously it is, but we just need to remind ourselves. Okay, second purpose, sex is designed for pleasure. As I said when I was talking about lust, sexual desire is not the problem. In fact, sexual desire is affirmed throughout the Bible. Like, you and I might get squeamish talking about sex. The Bible does not get squeamish about talking about sex. That's what's so interesting. The Bible is unabashedly says that God created sexuality, that sexuality is good. We have a whole book, the Song of Songs, which is dedicated to celebrating sexual love between a man and a woman. Even more, in 1 Corinthians 7:13, Paul basically commands sex to married couples. He says the husband should fulfill his marital duty to his wife, a radical departure that a husband would owe something to his wife. The husband would fulfill his marital duty to his wife, and likewise the wife to her husband. So interestingly, Paul doesn't mention procreation here. I don't think Paul ever actually mentions procreation as a reason for sex. He says that sexual pleasure is one of the sexual satisfaction is one of the reasons for sex. And we've probably moved past this idea that sex is dirty and the body is bad. I think we sometimes go on this kind of reactionary thing where I don't think you hear that message as much, but we need to remind ourselves that the Bible affirms sex and sexual pleasure as a good thing. But we can't stop there. Because the third purpose of sex is to unite two people. It's to bring them into union. Now, this is going to be the hardest one to get your mind around, but it's also the most important. So think about this one. We've got to understand this one because the first two, sex creates baby and sex is fun and pleasurable. Like, I don't have to spend a lot of time convincing you that's true. Like, the culture will tell you that. It's pretty self-evident. This one is what Paul calls what we just talked about in our class this morning, a mystery. This whole idea of uniting. But if we don't rest in this reason, we're not going to understand why sex is limited to the context of marriage. So one of the terms that best expresses this is one that I never really hear, and the only time I hear it is in reference to prison visits, is the conjugal visit. That's like a weird term, but it's actually one of the best because conjugal means co-joining. It's really the best description of what happens at sex because what sex does is it co-joins two people. This is what Paul says, this is what Genesis says, that two people become one. They become one flesh. And that's a hard thing to get your mind around. So I'm not going to probably be able to help you with that, but I think I can convince you that there's some bonding effect that happens with sex. There's something powerful about sex that bonds two people together. It's one of the reasons why often people stay too long with somebody, because they're so bonded with someone sexually. It's a powerful bond. And here's what's happening. When you pull sex and you take it out of marriage, here's what you're saying. I want you to be united with me physically. I want this one part of you to unite with me, but not the rest of my life. Many of you are married. When you marry, you join your whole lives together. Your assets become their assets become your assets, at least in most cases. Bank accounts merge, you have children, you're joined with that person forever. You're never gonna not be joined with that person. Stuff comes together when you get married. And sex is saying to another person, I want a physical union with you, I want the pleasure you have to offer me, I just don't want those other unions. And let me see if I can kind of put this in a way because to communicate this. Imagine like asking someone out on a first date and saying, I also wonder if we could kind of combine bank accounts tonight. That'd be possible. And like, can I put my name on your credit card for a couple weeks? I hope you would say like, heck no, I'm not going to be vulnerable with you that way. I don't even know you. Like, you might take my money and run off with it. Like, I can't expose myself to this massive risk that you're asking me to do. No, you want to merge bank accounts with me? No way. You want to merge bank accounts with me? Commit to me. Commit to me to a lifelong partnership. Commit to me that I know when things get hard, you're not going to run off with my money. And I think most of us would say, well, like, of course. Like, who merges their bank accounts on the first date? And yet something even more powerful, sex. We are so much more flippant with that. We're so much more flippant with that. We offer that, and we encourage people to offer that to another, having no idea the power that is there, being so naive about the power. And let me tell you another reason why I can convince you of bonding is happening. When you have sex with someone, you tend to say extravagant things to this person. You tend to say, like, I will always love you. Lots of strong words have been said during sex. But those promises in a hotel or the backseat of a car, that is not the same as promises made here in front of your church family, in front of your family, in front of your friends. That's a different, I'm always going to love you. Not to say that always works out, but those promises are very different when somebody's saying to you, I'll always love you while they're having sex with you, and I'll always love you in front of a congregation of believers who will hopefully join you in holding you accountable for that. Uniting with someone physically is powerful. And Christians don't think that sex belongs in the context of marriage because we think lowly of sex, because we're naive about sex. It's because we have such a high view of sex. It's because we think there's so much power to sex. And no matter how much our culture tries to deny it, it's a lie. Sex is a big deal. It's a big deal. And if you treat it, here's the deal. You can try to treat it like it's not a big deal. You can try to steel yourself and say, I'm going to have sexual relationships with this person, and I'm not going to do this whole uniting thing. And first of all, I don't think you're going to do it, but say you do succeed in doing that. What happens is that when you do then marry someone, you're taking away, you've diminished the power of sex to recovenant two people together. Because sex has a covenant-making power. This is, again, we're thinking about how does sex unite people? And every time a married couple has sex, they are, in a sense, having a recovenanting ceremony. I know that we don't usually think that, and often it doesn't feel that way. I get that. But we're again making our promises to that other person, I will be with you for the long haul. It's like I heard someone say, it's like putting a little bit more cement on the relationship. I mean, you guys, a lot of you have laid brick. You're putting this bonding agent on. And every time you then have sex with your spouse, you're adding a little bit more cement to that. In his book, The Meaning of Marriage, Tim Keller and his wife describes sex in marriage as oil in an engine. I like this. He says, without it, friction between all the moving parts will burn out the motor. I think that's a great description. I mean, you guys know motors, you know oil. Because marriage is hard. Because in marriage, there's anger, there's disappointment, there's resentment. There is a lot of friction. Even in good marriages, there's a lot of friction. And if you don't have ways, this is not the only way. Sex doesn't solve your problems in your marriage, but it does have a way of bringing you back together, of uniting you again, of putting that glue on that covenant together. I don't think I've spent this much time thinking about the biblical understanding of sex, and I just found myself just amazed at the wisdom of the Bible. Sometimes I'm a little bit older now. I heard a lot of this growing up, and it didn't always make sense, and it doesn't always make sense, but I'm a little bit older now, and I've been married a little bit longer now, and I just think the biblical understanding of sex is right on. And we're going to be countercultural here. If we hold this view up, we are going to always be in the counterculture. But that doesn't mean we're wrong. I think when we look back like at the history of this, we see that there's so much wisdom to this. Now, what if you are not been chased? What if you are not chased right now? The point of this sermon, I have to end it this way, is not to shame you. The point is to say, like I said, there are reasons behind the Christian teaching about sex. We're not just trying to tell you don't have fun, don't have pleasure. We think that sex matters, and that's why we think it should be handled carefully. And I think we need to end this, because I get it. This elicits some hard stuff, maybe from our past, maybe right now. And I want you to remember the story in John's gospel that we looked at last year of the woman caught in adultery. And one of the things I was so struck, here's this woman caught in sexual sin, and Jesus is so tender with this woman. He's so tender. The Pharisees and the teachers of law, they're ready to stone her. And Jesus kneels down and he says, if any one of you is without sin, let him be the first to throw a stone at her. And then after they leave, he looks up and he says, she's the only one there. And she says, neither do I condemn you. Go now and leave your life of sin. So look at what Jesus says. He doesn't condemn her, but he names what she's done as sin. He doesn't say, what you did was fine. He says, I don't condemn you. Now leave that behind. So we come to Jesus really humbled, I think most of us, grateful that there is not condemnation because we do things and we look back and we realize we shouldn't have done those. That there's mercy and forgiveness to be found with Jesus. That's a gift. It's a gift that our sins, our past sins, even if they are still creating damage, they can be forgiven. It's not to say that's easy or that's not going to take a lot of work, but they can be forgiven. But at the same time, Jesus will not let her leave without being challenged to take seriously what he's saying about sex.